Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, it is said that creative people tend to see the world a little differently than anyone else. But does that always mean they can't stay focused, that they can't zero in and achieve their goals and earn money doing their creative work? Coming up around 12:20, my second guest says that's nonsense. Creatives can do all that and more. And she is Sam Bennett. She's worked alongside some of today's biggest creatives, such as comic Steve Carell and Stephen Colbert. Sam Bennett's new book is called Get It Done, From Procrastination to Creative Genius in 15 Minutes a Day. Love this book. It's fun. Ending today's show, award-winning journalist Poe Bonson joins me again today to join more insights from his New York Times best-selling book, Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. He co-wrote that book with Ashley Merriman. And we're going to start today's show with someone who's widely known as the talent maximizer. Roberta Chinsky-Matcheson is my first guest. She's the president of Matcheson Consulting and the Washington Post bestselling author of Suddenly in Charge. She's helped leaders in Fortune 500 as well as small and medium-sized businesses achieve dramatic growth and market leadership by optimizing talent. Matcheson is frequently quoted in business publications. She's a top-ranking blogger for Fast Company and Forbes. And she's also, and I think this is kudos to her, one of the only handful of people who have appeared as a guest on Bill O'Reilly's O'Reilly Factor and actually left the show unscathed. Her new book is called Talent Magnetism, How to Build a Workplace That Attracts and Keeps the Best. Roberta Matcheson, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. And I'm going to begin with your appearance on the O'Reilly Factor, you escaping unscathed. What? How did you do that? Did you just agree with everything he said?
Actually, Bill agreed with everything I said.
Oh.
So I got very, very lucky.
That's the way to do it, I think.
Exactly.
So let's talk about this book, Talent Magnetism, How to Build a Workplace That Attracts and Keeps the Best. This is a very critical component of a successful business, whether you are running a Fortune 50 company or whether you've got, you know, a one-man office and you just need a little bit of extra help. We hear a lot about hiring the best, attracting the best, retaining the best talent from corporate leaders, but the reality of it often fall short. So let's just take a quick summary of the book and why you wrote it, why you felt it was important to share.
Well, I wrote the book because I could see from my experience in working with, you know, Fortune 500 companies as well as small and medium-sized companies that attracting and, more importantly, retaining top people was something that I saw my clients struggling with, both in good times and in bad times. So, for example, when there seemed to be an abundance of talent, clients and prospects just didn't seem to have the time to go through all those resumes and select the right person. And now that we're seeing that pendulum shift and it's getting harder and harder to get great people, again, prospects and clients are struggling because they've got open positions, and they're having a tough time getting top people to come work for them.
Yeah, and we hear about movement in the economy and jobs are getting more abundant. Are you finding that's true or not? I mean, where's the struggle there for companies?
I am finding that that is so true. I mean, you've got two scenarios that I've seen lately. Number one, people quitting their jobs without any job to go to, because they've gotten to the point where they're like, I am out of here, And they're confident that they will find something else. So this whole business of your quote-unquote, my only option is no longer true.
Yeah.
And then you have the other side of the coin where people are being plucked. They're being plucked out of organizations, and companies don't even know that these pluckers are inside their companies until it's too late.
Yeah, one of the things you say, and this is a common maxim, is that people don't work for companies, they work for people.
Mm-hmm.
And your whole premise is that leaders should be talent magnets, again, whether they're Fortune 50 companies or small business owners. So let's look at some of the examples that make up what you call a magnetic leader. What might they look like? How might they behave?
Well, this is the kind of person who really does have other people's best interests in mind, and they put their people before their own interests at all times. And these are people who are pretty honest and forthright with their employees, and they tell them when they're doing a great job, and they also tell them when they're not so that these people can improve. And they're also very transparent. And if you've worked in the corporate world, and many of your listeners I'm sure have, you know that transparency is not something that is, you know, readily available to most, meaning a lot of people have hidden agendas. But when you work for somebody who is very open and really wants to see you succeed, it's a whole different experience.
Yeah.
And it's a rare moment.
Yes, it is a very rare moment. I think we can all relate to that and all think of people that we'd work for in a heartbeat and other people we wouldn't want to go anywhere near again.
Exactly.
Beyond that, you say it's important to establish strong brand employment or a strong employment brand. Let's look at what that might look like.
Well, I find what happens in organizations is that when they think about their employment brand, which is their reputation, both for, you know, from job seekers and people who are currently employed in their firm and people who have left, it's usually an afterthought. So, for example, if I were to go on to somebody's website and I wanted to apply for a job, I mean, that could be hidden 20 layers underneath everything else. So I may move on to another site because there's nothing there that attracts me. And sometimes there's no way for me to even apply.
Yes. And, you know, from personal experience, some of them are extremely funky to use and you just get frustrated and move on to the next one.
Absolutely.
So what other things beyond the website?
Well, it's your reputation. And I find that a lot of companies aren't managing that reputation very well. So, you know, people are going on to websites like Glassdoor.com, and they're making comments. And more cases than not, those comments aren't very favorable, and employers aren't checking those sites. So they're not doing anything to either improve their reputations. They're not asking their employees to go on to the site and post something that's more positive because that employee believes it's a great place to work. But, you know, more importantly, they're not going to their employees and, you know, taking the temperature of the organization.
Mm-hmm.
They're not doing climate surveys, so they have no idea if their people are happy and it's sunny or if it's, you know, pouring rain on the organization. They're just operating like businesses as usual,
right,
which is a huge mistake.
Right. I remember the Gallup poll did a study not too long ago. We talked about it on one of our business shows that showed just how many employees in America are disengaged. And, you know, obviously that's not going to attract more people because you're going outside of the place and complaining about work.
Right. It's going to repel people, including customers, because why would you do business in a place where the employees are miserable?
You say employee quietness is the silent killer. And I'm assuming that happens based on a little bit of what you've said. You know, people, the management leadership is too far removed. You know, I think back to leaders that I've admired, and they've been, they're not necessarily in your face, they're not micromanaging, but they know what's going on with you, and they know you exist.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, the quietness that I've seen has been when, you know, you're working in a kind of environment where you might have a dictatorial style of leadership.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're told this is your job, get it done.
Right.
And so there's no opportunity to have a conversation. There's no opportunity to bring any innovative ideas forward. There's no opportunity to have any fun at work. So it's very, very quiet.
Right. You say some of the signs that employee morale is sinking, you know, employee turnover is on the rise, sick time is on the rise, productivity is declining, customer complaints are increasing, revenues decreasing. I mean, these are all dead giveaways.
Mm-hmm.
How important is culture? I was watching a video with Tony Hsieh, founder of Zappos, and he says that fitting their culture when they bring somebody in is far more important, far more critical than bringing somebody in who's going to do a fantastic job. He said if they have people in their organization who really do a fantastic job, but they don't fit the culture, they simply let them go.
And they pay them to leave.
Yes.
And I adore Tony. I have followed his work for years. I think he is a very smart businessman, and I think that there's so many lessons that other business owners can learn from him. That, you know, in everything he's done in his organization, very little of it requires a lot of cash. You know, the way he's created that culture, mm-hmm. you know, he's just really done it right.
You say employee retention may not necessarily always be a good thing, though.
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, I have said that, and I said that just the other day with a client who was telling me that, you know, he hasn't had anybody leave in 25 years. And I'm like, well, that's a huge problem. You know, and he sort of got quiet. And he was like, well, what do you mean? I'm like, well, you've got no fresh ideas coming in. There's no place to breathe. You're breathing your own exhaust. You've probably got people, if I asked you, would you hire them again today? More, you know, most likely you tell me absolutely not. So, you know, your turnover may be zero, but that's not such a great thing.
Right. So let's look at a few of the myths that people, you know, they say, I don't have time to hire the best people. I don't have the resources. I don't have the money. We're really not all that special. I mean, how do we overcome that kind of thinking? You talk a lot about the rule of attraction in the book, which kind of surprised me in the beginning until I saw how you fitted it all in.
Well, you know, if you think about it, if you don't think that you're worthy of talent, then why would anybody come work for you?
Right.
You know, so when you look at that, but the real key behind all of this is that you don't need a lot of talent when you have top talent.
So, go ahead.
Think about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and here's the other thing. You don't need top talent in every single position. You know, let's just say you're a manufacturing company. You don't necessarily have to have, like, you know, somebody out of Harvard, you know, running your accounts payable department.
Right.
So, you can pick and choose, where am I going to put my energy right now? If I have limited resources, where do I need the strongest people?
Right, right. Let's look at if you have a small business. And, you know, and I know from being a manager for many, many, many years myself, you know, and I've managed really large teams, 100 people and more. Sometimes you are so desperate for a body. You bring a person in that may not be your first choice, but you're just desperate. And I've learned from painful mistakes not to do that anymore. I think it's even more critical when you're in a small business. You know, you might be a one or two man operation, and, you know, bringing somebody in can literally make or break your business. So what kind of advice do you give to people with small businesses?
Well, my advice is this: it's all about the attraction, because if you've got that attraction, when you have an opening, you will have people who will be contacting you. Or you'll have people who will say, you know, I'd really love to come in and talk to you. I've heard some great things about your company, and I think I can add value. So, you know, putting your energy in a place where you can attract people by being active in your community, people knowing your name, knowing your company, it will not just help you attract new customers, but it will also enable you to connect with, you know, potential candidates so that you will have your pick of the best.
Mm-hmm. And one,
but you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, there are ways to close those gaps that don't require, you know, a wedding band. So
right.
You can close them by using some temp employees. You can, you know, get some interns. You can hire interim employees, you know, before you make that commitment.
Yes.
If you can't find the right person.
Yeah. And I must admit, I myself found some really great employees who were working through a temp agency, and they just gelled really well, and it worked out for everybody.
Absolutely.
You talk about, you call it the donut principle, and this is another thing that happens. You just get your team where you want it, and you think, oh, this is fantastic. You know, we've got some great people here. You know, all of our strengths and weaknesses are coming together to make this great unit. And then a key player leaves, and then a little time after that, another key player leaves. And you call that the donut principle. Talk to us about that, if you would.
I call it the donut principle because what is left is a big round hole with a sprinkling of mediocre workers, because talent wants to work with talent. And when they see the good people leaving, they look around and they go, uh-oh, something's up. And then they go. Or when the good people leave, they call up their buddies and say, hey, this is a great place. Why don't you come work over here? You know, and keeping in mind, a lot of companies are offering employee referral bonuses. So when somebody leaves and they bring somebody with them, there's usually a nice little payment for that. So, I mean, that's what happens. And so you're so afraid to do anything because if you lose more people, you feel like you won't be able to function, that you allow the mediocre people to just hang out.
Right, right. How do you suggest if you've got people who are just hanging out? Because it is very detrimental to an organization if you've got disengaged employees, how do you suggest you sort those out?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because I just facilitated a strategic retreat for an organization about a week ago. And the CEO had an idea that something wasn't quite right, but he couldn't put his finger on it. And it was interesting because being able to step back, which is something that, you know, CEOs don't get to do all that much. It was very clear to him which members of his team were really stars and which ones were just hanging out. And by the end of the session, you know, he sat down and he goes, I got to do something, don't I? And my reply was, yeah, you do. And he knew exactly what he needed to do.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you got to either get an outside person to come in and help you, you know, evaluate the team you have, or, you know, write it down and talk to a trusted advisor that you might have in one of your CEO clubs. But you got to take action because it never really gets better on its own.
Right. One of the things we used to hear all the time when I worked in the financial industry was, you know, your employees don't leave because of money. So tell us why they leave. You have a whole chapter on this. Tell us why employees really leave a company.
They really leave because of their bosses, and that was what was so interesting. When I wrote Talent Magnetism, it really came back to my first book, Suddenly in Charge, because Suddenly in Charge is all about, you know, how do you be this great leader that everyone wants to follow? And, you know, I do a lot of work coaching new leaders, coaching executives, you know, developing, you know, managers. And it always comes back to the leadership. It does. I mean, there's, you know, you can do all the studies in the world.
Yeah.
So but if you use common sense, it comes back to, really, would you want to go in every day and work for this person?
Okay. So what, they're too harsh or not, they don't acknowledge enough? What's going on there? Do we know that?
They're not managing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're either, you know, doing the work themselves, because they don't trust that the people they have can do it as good as they can. They are not giving direction. They are not giving feedback. In some cases, they're just not nice people. In other cases, they don't really want to be in management, but they were thrown in there and they don't know how to get out.
Okay. Well, good advice. I thank you for being with us today, Roberta Matcheson. Final word you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Yes. Well, you know, if they'd like any more information, I can be reached at roberta@matchesonconsulting.com. And my website's matchesonconsulting.com.
Okay. And Matcheson is spelled MATUSON, just to avoid any confusion there. And the book, again, is called Talent Magnetism, How to Build a Workplace That Attracts and Keeps the Best. Some good advice in there. Thanks, Roberta, for being with us today.
Thank you.
Please do stay with us. When we come back, we'll be joined by Sam Bennett. Her book is really fun. It's called Get It Done, From Procrastination to Creative Genius in 15 Minutes a Day. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please stay with us.
Another big riot. You blow a fuse. Sing boom. The Democrats lose. Sing boom. So what's the use? Wow! Of falling in love.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
More than 100 million wild animals are killed each year illegally. Poaching is a major threat to our country's wildlife. I'm Tom Barry. I'm an actor with a desire to preserve living space for wildlife. The Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust does just that. Works with private landowners to protect wildlife, to preserve natural habitats. To learn more or to work with the Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust, call 800-729-SAVE. That's 800-729-SAVE or visit wildlifelandtrust.org. Thank you.
Next week on Conversations Live, award-winning journalist and author Melinda Blau helps couples strengthen their relationships and create stronger family connections and family whispering. Join us every Monday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m. and 98.9 HD Channel 3. See conversationslive.net for upcoming show details and podcasts.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Alternative to what? Alternative to everything else out there on the radio. Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
It's nice and
I can tell Eric's getting creative with our music here. Welcome back, everyone, to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and we're going to be talking creativity in this segment. My guest is Sam Bennett. She worked at the renowned Second City Theater in Chicago alongside comics Steve Carell and Stephen Colbert. In addition to her multifaceted writing and performance work, she specializes in personal branding and career strategies, and she lives down in Los Angeles. Her website is theorganizedartistcompany.com, and she's written a really good new book called Get It Done, From Procrastination. I'm procrastinating on reading the title here. From Procrastination to Creative Genius in 15 Minutes a Day. Sam Bennett, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Vicky. Thank you for having me. Hi, everybody.
My pleasure. And you have been teaching this material that's in this book since about 1996, I read. So why write the book now?
Yeah, the book sort of wrote itself over a long period of time. It really came out of my own work as a creative person trying to figure out, you know, when you can do anything, how do you pick which projects to go forward on? How do you know? How can you discern which one's the right way to go? And you know, there's a lot of organization books out there, but most of them are geared towards business people. And let's face it, creative people don't really care who's moved their cheese.
Right.
And, you know, and then there's all the creativity books, which are great, but they're a lot about spiritual healing through creativity or, you know, sort of getting in touch with your inner creative. And for those of us whose inner creative is already plenty outer, thank you very much. You know, how do you move forward when there's no quarterly review on how you're radio show is going, or how your podcast is going, or how your novel is coming along, or how your painting is going.
Right. And if you have a book in your head, who cares if it comes out, you know, unless they know about it.
So. Exactly. And we manage to get everything done for everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And the projects that matter most to us stay undone.
Right.
And that's what I'm fighting up against.
Yeah. So this book is packed full of exercises and inspiring true success stories to help give us insight into what turns underperforming geniuses, as you call us, into accomplished artists. So let's start with this. You say procrastination is genius in disguise. What do you mean by that?
I mean that the fact that there's something that you've been thinking about long enough to procrastinate on it, right? It's an idea that keeps coming around and around and around, and you think, oh, I really got to get to that. Yep, I really got to do that. Yep, yep, yep. If you think of that idea as a friend sort of tapping on your shoulder or pulling on your sleeve going, hey, hey, didn't you want to paint me? Didn't you want to make me? Didn't you want to do
right.
something with me? It's that persistent desire is really good news because you've had a million ideas that you've had once and sort of never thought of again. So the fact that this idea is coming back around, it's coming back around, that is your creative genius tugging on your sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
I know. So if you get away from sort of the nagging feeling of it, you know, and the low, you know, like, oh, I'm a failure because I'm not getting to it. But really just focus on the desire part of it. You can really start to see the genius.
Yes. And I know I've kept a book with me for several years. I've got way over 100, probably over 200 ideas in there at some point. And one of the things you talk about in the book is how do we decide what ideas we're going to work on and how to start approaching that. So, but you say one of the things that keeps us procrastinating is perfectionism. So let's address that first of all. And you talk about the top three things to do to get past that perfectionism. I wonder if you'd share those with our listeners.
Yeah, my favorite strategy in getting over perfectionism is get a C.
Right.
Get a C. Quit trying to get an A+ in everything. Get a C. C is the grade that you get for showing up and doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
And not doing it better than anybody else and not doing it fancier and not getting any extra credit work. Just show up, do the work. And I can hear all the apple polishers out there, you know, and I'm one of them, like going, oh, no, 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 I have to get an A. You know, it's one of the things school does to us is it sort of indoctrinates us in this way. But really, you can afford to do this for a couple of reasons. One is, I'm going to bet that your version of a C is pretty much everybody else's version of an A. Second of all, if you do your work and you do get it out there, you know, you get that short story out there, or you start blogging, or you start, you know, making your jewelry or whatever it is you want to be doing, and then it needs to be made more perfect, you find out actually it's really not as good as it should be, then you'll make it more perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's how you roll. You'll revise. You'll improve. It's fine.
Right. Right. I think, you know, I think back to when I first started writing and I wanted it to be perfect first time. And of course, it never is. It's a case of going back and revisiting. But I was watching Pride and Prejudice at the weekend, and Jane Austen actually wrote Pride and Prejudice, I think, first. But it lay in a drawer for 15 years because she thought it wasn't any good. And then after Sense and Sensibility was a success, she pulled that out and reworked it 15 years later.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
We hear that kind of thing all the time, and somehow we think it applies to everybody else except us.
Yes, yeah.
And really, you are not the best judge of your work.
So how do we get, if we've got this list of projects, how do we start narrowing them down? How do we get over that, you know, some people are in the planning stage forever, or what you call the getting ready to get ready syndrome.
Right, getting ready to get ready. Yeah, there's a lot of different ways, and there's a couple of really powerful exercises in the book, actually, that we don't have time to walk you through now, but they're in the Get It Done book, and that'll really help you discern. Because, and again, especially for creative people, there's no right way. There really isn't a right answer. So the advice I would give you sort of generally is, one, really go for the projects that are closest to your heart, the ones that you know will really make a difference to you in your life, that'll make a difference 10 years from now, that'll make a difference in your business. Put those at the top of the list. The other two strategies, it's a little bit like paying off credit cards. You know, either go for the one that's closest to being done,
mm-hmm.
just so you can get something done and get that nice, satisfying sense of completion, or go for the one that is going to have the biggest return on investment.
Right, right. And, you know, I'm going to address the second part of the title here. The book is called Get It Done, From Procrastination to Creative Genius in 15 Minutes a Day. A lot of people might say 15 minutes isn't enough to accomplish anything. But if we do it daily, that's what you're talking about here, right?
I've got to tell you, my clients and students who employ this 15-minute-a-day strategy see the most incredible, jaw-dropping, nearly miraculous results. It's incredible. I can't tell you the emails and phone calls I get. You know, Sam, I never thought this would work. I totally rolled my eyes. But, you know, especially my private clients, you know, they pay me a lot of money, so they have to do what I say. You know, so they give it a try. And sure enough, first of all, it's amazing how much work you can get done in 15 minutes. Second of all, it absolutely bypasses that perfectionism thing. It's another really valuable tool for getting over perfectionism, because how perfect can you make it in 15 minutes, right? Mm-hmm. You just got to do it. Third, you're doing it every day. Every single day before you check your email, before you check your email, before you check your email, spend your 15
Got
minutes
it.
A day on the projects you love. I'm telling you, once that email's open, the day is over.
You're so right. You're so right on that.
And everybody can wait for 15 minutes. Everybody can wait for 15 minutes. There's nothing you have to do that can't be put off for another 15 minutes.
And I love that, though, because, you know, we think that we have to sit down for 4 hours or 8 hours and get something done, but we can all grab 15 minutes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I like to do it early in the day. That's what works best for me. But I have a friend who wrote 2 award-winning plays during her lunch hour, which of course wasn't really an hour. It was really sort of a lunch 20 minutes. I know people who've completed paintings, large-scale sculptures, jewelries, theses, graduate theses. I mean, it's astonishing. Because it's the 15 minutes. It's every single day. It's that momentum feeling. And sometimes, sure, you sit down and you do get up 4 hours later. You just get on a roll and you're like, wow, that was great. And other times, you know, you sort of stare at it for 15 minutes. And either way, it's fine. And it also, I think, it kind of lets the angel know you're serious. You know how that is when you take a couple of steps towards the thing you want and it's like the universe just comes rushing at you?
Right, right.
That's the other thing that happens, is because your awareness is now on your project and you're thinking about it more and you're active, you're moving your feet. And that's when things happen, like I was just in line at the dry cleaners and the person next to me's brother is a literary agent and this happened and that happened, or, you know, that's when those incredible coincidences happen. That's when you find just the thing you're looking for at just the moment you need it.
Yeah.
It's
sparking something in that reticular system of the brain. It's activating something there. We notice things we didn't notice before.
That's right, because we're very good at finding what we're looking for.
Yeah. You talk about you prefer could-do lists versus to-do lists. Talk to us about the difference there.
Yeah, I find to-do too much pressure.
Right,
too much pressure. And I like being in the space of could-do. Like, it reminds me that I'm in the driver's seat of my life. I could do my taxes. I could take the consequences of not doing my taxes. Like, I am at choice, right?
That's right.
I could do the laundry. I could walk around in dirty clothes. You know, I have a choice. I may not like the alternative, but reminding myself that I have choices, that I am not painted into a corner, keeps me out of any kind of self-victimizing mode. It also allows me to put things on the list that I'm pretty sure I will never do, but that are sort of entertaining to think about. You know, I could call Oprah. You know, I could, you know, contact this person or try this or, you know, investigate moving to Indiana. I could do all kinds of things.
Right.
And to be able to put it down. I mean, I don't know about you, but sometimes I feel like, you know, when I commit to a goal, it's like I'm being chased by a pack of wild dogs. You know, I get very hard on myself. So to stay in a could-do really sort of, it keeps me feeling a little looser and lets my imagination go a little more freely.
I can see that. I can see that working, yeah. And one of the things you talk about is maybe you need to increase the scope of your project. If you're stuck on a project or you just, you know, stopped working on it, it could be just because you're bored. And I can think of several projects where I've got to that phase. It's, you know, you need to get some reignition there. So talk to us about how we might do that.
Yeah, I love this strategy. I mean, I know there's a lot of conventional wisdom in the world that says, you know, well, you should just focus on one thing and, you know, start small and see how it goes. But I don't know, Vicki. For me and for a lot of the creative people I know, I don't like to start small. I like to start big.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to have three or four kind of big projects going on at the same time. Now, notice I said three or four, not 10 to 12.
Right.
But sometimes, yeah, especially if you find yourself feeling kind of bored with a project, add a zero to what, you know, if you're thinking, oh, I think I should make 10 greeting cards. Well, what happens if you make 100? You know, or I'm trying to make $1,000. Well, what if you tried to make 10,000?
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, I want to add, you know, 5,000 people to my email list. Well, what if you tried to make it 50,000?
Right.
Like all of a sudden, changing the scope, or sometimes we think too big and then we scare ourselves, you know, or it feels overwhelming. Like, I don't know how I would do 50,000. That's, you know, if thinking too big shuts you down and makes you frightened, then go really tiny then.
Right.
Go the other way. Adjust the scope down. How would you get five?
Right. Yeah, because it can go either way. It can go either way, for sure. One of the chapters you've devoted to developing your creativity toolkit, we've already talked about creating that 15 minutes a day for ourselves. What are the tips do you have there?
I'm a big fan of idea catchers. Every creative person needs to have some kind of idea catcher because you're having great ideas all the time. But if you are not capturing them somewhere, they're just going to kind of float away. I like index cards. Mm-hmm. I think they're cheap and cheerful, and again, whole pieces of paper tend to intimidate me. You know, like I feel like
right.
It's got to be serious.
So and you can color code them. You can color code them,
exactly.
Which is what I like.
You can color code them. You can tuck them in your pocket. They're also great for grocery lists and, you know, giving to kids to doodle on. They have 1,000 uses. But whatever works for you. Some people like to use the voice memo function on their smartphone. Some people call themselves and leave themselves a message. You know, there's... experiment with what works for you. Like I said, I write things down on my index cards, and especially if it's an idea that I'm not going to move forward on right now, I will put it in a big manila envelope on my desk labeled Genius and just let it nest there.
I'm going to create one of those.
Yeah, it's great because this thing, everything needs a home. A lot of people are good at capturing ideas, but then they don't have any place to put them afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So give it a home. And then when you're feeling kind of stuck or you need to come up with an article or a blog post or a speech or you've got to say something interesting to someone, you can just reach your hand into that envelope and pull out something that's going to spark your thinking again.
Mm. You say sometimes it's really important to just rename our projects. Why is that, Sam?
Sometimes I think we're not moving forward on projects because they sound awful. You know, oh, I've got to revise my manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sounds like homework. It sounds terrible. You know, oh, I've got to clean out the garage. You know, if you think, though, I have to revise my manuscript, I need to polish the diamond of my work. Oh, that sounds kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not cleaning out the garage. I'm creating a space for genius cabinet making, you know, for brilliant bike storage. I'm creating clear, open space for play and, you know, to think of the result. And just think of a name that just kind of makes you smile or makes you giggle or feels kind of sexy or fun. It's a little bit like telling a kid that going to the grocery store is a treasure hunt.
Mm-hmm.
But that works for big kids, too, you know. If you just make it a little more fun, it's amazing how it doesn't feel so onerous, you know, it just doesn't feel so hard.
I know one of the things that works for me, I am a big picture thinker and a very visual thinker. So I do try to always keep the big picture in mind. And I think sometimes you lose the sense of enjoying the process when you do that. And so when I catch myself doing that, I have to go back to, you know, let's just enjoy the process. Let's put something pretty on to wear or something.
Mm-hmm.
And let's just sit down with my favorite drink and enjoy the process as I'm going through this.
That's exactly right. And I think, again, especially for creative people, and when I say creative people, I kind of mean everyone. Everyone is a creative genius.
Yes, yeah.
Not everyone is artistic, but everyone is a creative genius. And So to appeal to you, and we respond to the senses, you know. So yes, put on your favorite music. Wear the clothes that make you feel powerful or sexy or relaxed. And
you
get to be the grown-up in your life. Have fun.
Yeah, you give a great example in the book of an actor who was raising babies with his wife. And when you connected with him, you told him, put a suit on and go out to meet your agents. He'd been procrastinating on making that phone call to his agents. That was a good story.
Yeah, he took the Get It Done workshop because he had to make a phone call.
Yeah.
Which sounds ridiculous to pay to take a class because you can't make yourself make a phone call, but we've all done it.
Right.
Right? That call that you need to make, and then you don't make it, and then it's been too long, and then you really don't make it, and then you really don't make it, and then you really don't know what to say because it's really been too long. But you still have to make it, but you're still not making it. Like, it's, you know, it can be really crushing. And this is the thing that I want to say, too. Procrastination hurts. It hurts your heart. It hurts your self-esteem. It hurts your relationships. It hurts your bottom line. It hurts your business. You know, we get a little used to that nagging voice. We get a little accustomed, I think, to the pain of it sometimes. But I really want you to notice how not moving forward on that thing that you know will make a big difference in your life is actually hurting inside. And moving forward on it, even the tiniest bit, even just 15 minutes, feels so great.
Right, right. It does. It does for sure. And this is a great book to get you in the mood to do that. A lot of fun in here. I can tell you really enjoy your work, Sam. Final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Yeah. The world needs your work. The world needs your art. The world is waiting for your good work. So quit depriving yourself creatively and quit depriving us. We need it.
There you go. You heard it from the master herself, Sam Bennett. Thanks so much for being with us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much, Vicki. It was lovely talking with you.
And the book, again, is called Get It Done, From Procrastination to Creative Genius in 15 Minutes a Day. Great reviews on this. And you can find out more about Sam Bennett and her work at TheOrganizedArtistCompany.com, TheOrganizedArtistCompany.com. And we will be right back. We're going to take a very quick break. When I come back, we'll be talking with Poe Bronson of Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. Please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations, both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Designing Health, makers of Missing Link, we cover the world of animals. This week, February 23rd, it's the last Sunday of the month already, and that means it's Shelter, Rescue Sanctuary, and anything that helps our animal friends Sunday. We'll check in with Mollywood Avian Sanctuary, Macaw Rescue and Sanctuary, and Allbreed Equine Rescue. Plus, we'll wrap up the saga of Olympic Animal Sanctuary and what's happened to all of the dogs. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Next week on Conversations Live, award-winning journalist and author Melinda Blau helps couples strengthen their relationships and create stronger family connections and family whispering. Join us every Monday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m. and 98.9 HD Channel 3. See conversationslive.net for upcoming show details and podcasts.
Conversations Live is giving away books, from New York Times best-selling fiction to the latest from innovative thought leaders in business and psychology. To find out where, when, and how, like us on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, and look out for posts titled Book Giveaway.
Proud to bring variety to your radio dial. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And we're talking now with Poe Bronson. Together with Ashley Merriman, their work has changed the national dialogue on a number of topics. Beyond their best-selling books, you know them probably from commentary and features in the New York Times, CNN, NPR, Newsweek, Wired, New York, and many other sources. And together they authored the New York Times bestseller Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. They've also written for Time, Newsweek, New York, and The Guardian, et cetera, et cetera. And they've won 9 national awards for their reporting, 9 national awards. And today we're talking with Poe Bronson about their New York Times bestseller, Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. And this is coming out in paperback tomorrow, so very timely here. Poe Bronson, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Vicki. It was nice to talk to you.
Yeah, and last time we were here, I'm going to point listeners to that. Go look at conversationslive.net and just do a search for Poe Bronson. You can hear the first talk that we had on this. Today we're going to look at some different insights from the book, and the book is a blend of science and storytelling. It reveals what's truly in the heart of a champion. I'm wondering, you've been talking about this book for a long time now. Do you ever get tired of it, or are you still winning with it?
You know, it's kind of an interesting question, Vicki, because one of the things that I learned about myself, I think it was true, but I tried to hide it, but the book let me free it up, is it has to do with competitive styles. And Ashley and I, my co-writer, have very different competitive styles. I am someone who likes to improvise. I like the high pressure, but for a short duration. I like to then hug it out, go have a beer, you know, and recuperate.
Right.
Ashley is very much of someone who likes it never to be too intense. She likes lots of preparation and very little improvisation. And she doesn't want it to end. She likes the continuous work that's like a slow, steady, resentful burn kind of thing. And we're two different styles. And we learned that there was underlying science for these patterns, and it helped me recognize myself. And so, yeah, sure, when the book came, hardcover came out, worked very hard for 3 months and then completely took a break and let myself rest. Ashley would not let herself. She was still going off on speeches every week. And so, you know, it's great for me to talk about the book at a time like this with the Olympics going on, the Academy Awards coming up, a lot of competition going on here in February. But I'm keyed up to do it again.
Yeah.
You know, because I rested and recuperated. And Ashley's, you know, she's still going strong. You know, that's her style.
Well, it's interesting you brought that up, because I want to, that's one of the questions I want to ask, is how do we identify our own competitive style? Because obviously we need to know that if we want to be successful.
There's a lot of different factors discussed in the book that affect our competitive style, and quite a few of them have to do with the psychology and biology of our reaction to stress and pressure. One of the factors that's, you know, this isn't, you could go get yourself a genetic test for this, but you kind of don't need to if you understand the idea. you know how some people seem to be really good with pressure, and but when it's no pressure, they kind of, you know, just kind of like fine. Mm-hmm. And there's other people who are great as long as in a low-pressure environment. When it's high pressure, you kind of can't count on them, mm-hmm. and they crumple. Well, it turns out to be the gene for that. The gene called the Compt gene has been nicknamed the warrior or worrier gene, and it's evenly distributed in our population. And so there are warrior genes and worrier genes out there, such that one quarter of us have only warrior, and one quarter of us have only worrier, and half of us have a mix. And if we have the warrior gene, we like stress and pressure, and in fact, our brains cannot think our clearest without the pressure. The pressure raises the dopamine levels up so we think clearly.
Yeah.
Then there's the other quarter of us, the opposite quarter of us, think great without stress and pressure, but we actually need any stress and pressure, and our brain does not work as well. We cannot think. We'll get the job done maybe because we have a lot of grit and determination, but can't really think quite as clearly in that circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually a gene. It's controlled by a gene that's evenly distributed. This is not like some rare gene we're talking about. We're talking about, you know, everybody's got one of these two styles.
That explains a lot. And I was laughing there because I think I'm one of those people who needs that, a certain amount of tension, as I call it.
No, that's right. It makes sense. You're performing, right? You perform all the time. And I'm that kind of person, too. And Ashley's the opposite, you know? And I've passed this on to my son, who is great on standardized tests, great in high-stakes soccer tournaments, you know, under stress and pressure. He turns it up.
Right.
And we don't quite know what I've got with my daughter yet. She's 9, haven't quite figured that out. But you know, once you see it, it's really quite apparent.
Well, since you're talking of children there, you say that when children make mistakes, this was an article there by Ashley, actually, in the New York Times on the subject. When children make mistakes, our job should not be to spin those losses into decorated victories. Instead, our job is to help kids overcome setbacks, to help them see that progress over time is more important. Because I've thought this for a long, long time. We give out trophies and awards, and they become meaningless.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was a volunteer, you know, growing up in the Northwest. My dad was a volunteer, and he helped run one of the soccer clubs in Seattle. I came down here, and as a volunteer, I run all of youth soccer in San Francisco, and that's what we used to do. You know, every kid got a trophy, and we've trimmed it way back to make them meaningful. And the thing, it's not just about what winning means. It really is important to not hide losing, because when we pretend losses are actually some sort of actual victory in a way, it almost as if losing is unmentionable. We make it more taboo to our kids. And think about this for a second. So to compete means to risk exposing yourself, to risk losing. Now, for us adults, the greatest accomplishments of our life took a risk. It was a risk to ask that person out. It was a risk to apply for that job. It was a risk to change careers. It was a risk to apply to that university that might reject you. A risk to move to this country.
Right.
You have to take big risks in life. Now, if you're afraid of losing, you're afraid of falling on your face in front of everybody, you'll never take that risk. What you have to do is start young and realize it's okay to lose. Yeah, we lost. No big deal. We come back and we play again next week. And through this sort of like low-cost, not taboo losing, you're not hiding it. You're not being yelled at for losing. But you experience losing and you realize it's not the end of the world. And when you realize it's not the end of the world, you won't be afraid to take risks later in life.
Right.
Important risks that really will define their life.
Right. Some fascinating material in here. I know I said that a lot last time we talked, but it just is. And some of it, you know, if I hadn't read it in the book and I knew it was and hadn't known it, how well researched it was, I would have been kind of skeptical about it. One of the things I want to ask here, especially because my producer is a musician and he has his own band, and one of the things in the book is that you say the best symphony orchestras have the most miserable musicians. What's going on there?
It's true. And then we're talking about symphonies and orchestras from around the world, high level, big city, you know, symphonies and orchestras. And so, first of all, to have a great orchestra, you need to have great musicians. And those great musicians do not grow up thinking they're going to be third chair, right? They grow up trying and hoping to be the soloist, the star. And then they don't quite make it, and they're forced to be on a team, basically. And rather than getting to stand out, they have to fit in. And it's not their natural inclination. So you to get stars on a team to be team players, you know, that's how you create a really good team, but they may not really be team players inherently. Mm. And so that's a starting point. The other point is that, you know,
we've got just about 30 seconds here, Poe. We've had about 30 seconds.
Okay, we all encounter difficulty, and it turns out that teams where there's discord is allowed tend to be able to challenge each other and push each other to pivot and change and improve. And teams that are just focused on team harmony are so focused on it being nice and friendly that they don't respond to change and challenge very well.
Interesting. Well, listeners can find out more. This book is packed full of really great information, and it's based on scientific fact. Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing by Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman. And you can find out more about their work at topdogbook.com and more about Poe at poebronson.com and Ashley at ashleymerriman.com. Poe Bronson, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
I want to let you know that the book comes out in paperback tomorrow, and you can find out the first interview at conversationslive.net. And we will be back next week live with a brand new show. Until then, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.